large truck was used by three XR Rebellion protesters on Tuesday to block at least two lanes of Melbourne's Westgate Bridge. Many road users complained bitterly about the disruption. One road user spoke to the ABC saying, "I think their cause is true, but I think their tactics are misguided and holier than thou," he said. "If they think this is going to make any difference whatsoever, they are dreaming." However, Victorian Greens leader Samantha Ratnam defended the protest, despite disruption to commuters. "We're seeing more and more people protest against what's happening to our climate, urging governments to take strong action to stop climate change," she said. "What these protesters are trying to do is raise the alarm on behalf of future generations." A story that had such a huge impact on Melbourne people and the blocking of a major thoroughfare, which you would think would make the front page. However, the story was relegated to page 5, and climate change still goes largely unnoticed. Viola Coco, one of the three protesters on the Westgate Bridge, is well known to all of us here at Climate Conversations. I say all, and that's really just me. And as I have her phone number, I thought I'd give her a call, although I know she's in jail, custody as they call it, but I thought by some sheer chance she may still have a mobile phone. So I gave her a call and got nothing, of course. So there's nothing to add there. Come on now, let's move to the formalities. This is the latest episode of Climate Conversations, and I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people, and I pay my respects to elders, past, present and emerging. Let's listen now to some audio from a Melbourne Age story about the protest.
More climate protests are planned for Melbourne next week after three demonstrators blocked traffic on Melbourne's Westgate Bridge on Tuesday. Extinction Rebellion is set to stage more disruptions, with a spokeswoman for the group saying activists plan to hold Rebel for Life demonstrations over 3 days beginning on March 13, calling on the government to declare a climate emergency. Those demonstrations will mimic protests the group organised in December, which included a slow march that stopped traffic in the CBD and led to the arrest of multiple protesters. The demonstrators on Tuesday included serial activist Deanna Violet Marie Coco, 33, who was jailed in December 2022 after being the first person charged under New South Wales's anti-protest laws for a protest on the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Coco, a 68-year-old man from Burnside Heights and a 51-year-old man from Williamstown, were all arrested and charged with public nuisance, hindering police, obstructing police and obstruction of a roadway after they allegedly used a truck to block traffic on the Westgate Bridge at 7:45 a.m., causing major delays. They then climbed onto the truck's roof to unfurl banners that said, "Climate breakdown has begun," and "Declare a climate emergency." Police detained the three protesters after using a cherry picker to remove them from the roof of the truck. All city-bound lanes on the bridge reopened shortly after 10 a.m. Three people climbed on top of the truck before lighting a flare. Police negotiated with the group, however, they refused to come down from the truck, a Victoria Police spokesperson said. In December 2022, Coco was sentenced to 15 months jail for her role in a protest on the Sydney Harbour Bridge and banned from going within 1 kilometre of the landmark. She was the first person to be charged under anti-protest laws the New South Wales government passed in April 2022. Which introduced fines of up to $22,000 and up to 2 years in jail for anyone found to have blocked major infrastructure. Coco's arrest drew condemnation from human rights groups and opponents of tough protest laws at the time. She was released after a court heard she was initially imprisoned on false information provided by the New South Wales Police. The New South Wales Supreme Court struck down part of the anti-protest laws in December 2023. Ruling that criminalising activities that cause partial closures or redirections around ports and train stations was constitutionally invalid. In Melbourne, Tuesday's protest created delays for city-bound commuters that continued throughout the morning. Traffic slowed down on a stretch of the Princes Freeway between the bridge to Point Cook Road, and along the Western Freeway on the M80 Ring Road. One driver reported taking 2 hours to travel just 13 kilometres. Another woman told the ABC her granddaughter would miss a hospital appointment for an electroencephalogram as a result of the protests. "She's 20 months old and they're coming from a regional area," the listener texted in. Caller Raj, stuck in traffic near Yarraville, said he supported the protesters' cause but thought their tactics were misguided. Isn't the idea of a civil society that everyone enjoys their own rights without stamping on other people's? He said. If they think this is going to make any difference whatsoever, they are dreaming. Sally, a teacher who spoke to ABC Radio, said climate change was creating anxiety among her students and there was a need to draw attention to it. She said she understood why drivers were frustrated, but that anger shouldn't be directed towards the protesters. There is something undemocratic about being an elected government and not doing something to protect your country, she said. The demonstration comes as political leaders from across Asia converge on Melbourne for the ASEAN-Australia Special Summit, which began this week. The summit includes a climate and clean energy transition forum, where delegates will focus on an accelerated clean energy transition. An Extinction Rebellion spokeswoman said the timeline and scale of proposed measures did not come close to the speed and level required. She added that Australia must show leadership at the ASEAN summit by declaring a climate and ecological emergency and calling on other ASEAN leaders to do the same. Opposition Senator Simon Birmingham called the protests pointless and bordering on counterproductive. It's thoughtless for the thousands and thousands of Victorians that it impacts, and it's pointless because it's not going to have an impact on policies of Southeast Asian nation leaders who are here, or frankly of Australia, he told ABC Radio. It is going to, in the counterproductive sense, just drive further divisiveness of people who see protest like this and think of it as an extremist action, rather than an important serious mainstream policy consideration. Birmingham said he had previously acknowledged the coalition had problems regarding climate policy during its time in power, but Australia's emissions still trended down during that period. We did oversee a period of significant investment in clean energy, of significant reduction in Australia's emissions, and they were important achievements, but of course, there is much more to be done to achieve net zero, he said. We are having tough decisions and discussions within the Liberal and National parties at present about how you track the pathway to net zero, including previously unspoken topics in Australia like the questions around nuclear energy. The protesters are due to appear in Melbourne Magistrates Court on Tuesday night.
Now we have 90 seconds from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Manufactured or mobile homes make up about 8% of the housing in Maine. Most of them are heated with oil, kerosene, or propane.
And all of these are relatively expensive heating fuels.
Dan Mistro is with Efficiency Maine, an agency that runs the state's energy efficiency programs. He says electric air source heat pumps can provide a cheaper and cleaner alternative. So his group has been running a pilot program to show that heat pumps can heat homes even during Maine's cold winters.
We had 2 days last year where it was 15 below, but we were fine. You know, I was very comfortable, so it worked well.
Mariana Casagranda of Freeport was one of 10 mobile homeowners who received a heat pump system in the first year of the program. She's used it as her sole source of heat since January 2022.
And it's been going great since then.
Participants had the option to revert to their old heating systems free of charge if they did not like the heat pumps. But nobody chose to. Casagranda says heating her home now costs less than when she was paying for propane. And she says she's happy to reduce her impact on the climate, so she's keeping her heat pump. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Let's listen now to this report from the Australian National University about the Duty of Care Act in federal parliament. And it begins with a question from the Independent Senator for Canberra, David Pocock, which is answered by ANU climate scientist Mark Howden.
The science is unequivocal, and the IPCC in its last assessment report said that the human influence on global warming is unequivocal. There is no uncertainty associated with it.
New fossil fuel projects anywhere in the world are not compatible with a 1.5 degree goal.
I'm Kate Lawrence, Climate Program Manager at the Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions.
I'm Tanya Russell, I'm a doctoral candidate at the Australian National University.
Well, we've come to Parliament House to have a look at the Senate inquiry into the duty of care amendment proposed for the Climate Change Act.
So the proposed amendment is to amend the Climate Change Act of 2022 to enshrine a duty of care towards future generations, and it's also called the Intergenerational Justice Bill. And so what this is hoping to do is to actually codify in statute a requirement for decision makers to consider the health and well-being of current and future generations in decisions that have certain environmental impacts and could pose climate change risks.
So ISED's put in a submission. We covered some points that the senators today were asking about. So issues on the measure at a project level of impact on health and well-being. How would we do that? And we've sent along Emma Aisbert and Hilary Bambrick to talk about that. And they've got expertise in emissions accounting, in health and epidemiology.
So climate change is something that, you know, obviously young people, children and young people and future generations are more going to be more affected than, say, any of us in this room as the climate warms. To support her comments about the focus being very narrow in terms of, or very limited in terms of the types of decisions that may be considered under this bill, and just to point the committee towards the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act in Wales from 2015. So that's an act that actually covers all government decision making. It compels government to consider children and young people in all their decisions. They have a future generations commissioner who acts as a guardian for children and young people and future generations. And what that does is it actually protects health, health and well-being more broadly than just through whether or not you approve environmental projects. It might be, you know, thinking about, you know, it could be housing, it could be, you know, urban design, it could be any sort of policies at all that do have those broader health and well-being impacts on children and future generations.
Yeah. Regarding the link between fossil fuel projects and climate change. And, of course, the International Energy Agency has made very clear, this is an agency that is not renowned for being particularly pro-renewables, that new fossil fuel projects anywhere in the world are not compatible with a 1.5 degree goal. So this is, you know, very clear objective analysis. I'd also like to point out for Australia's own net zero ambitions that the actual extraction process, of course, fossil fuels have greenhouse gas emissions associated with their use, which for Australia is largely in other countries, but also massive amounts of emissions, often mainly fugitive emissions associated with their extraction. And indeed, that's one of the fastest growing, particularly over recent decades, sources of emissions in Australia. That's significantly making it harder for us to meet our net zero ambitions, which means it's raising the cost of the rest of society of trying to make savings elsewhere to compensate. And indeed, the safeguard mechanism has been designed in a way that it does not address the expansion of fossil fuels. It's an intensity baseline, and so the safeguard mechanism does nothing to address this ever-growing source of emissions that goes on our national accounts.
That is that particularly when it comes to this area of large fossil fuel investments, there is an extremely powerful legal tool that the firms have at their disposal, whether they're actually foreign or not, as Clive Palmer has so clearly showed. International investment agreements and investor-state dispute settlement can be heavily weaponized against any government or agency that tries to knock back a development of a mine or a gas expansion. And so I think it's really important that that's a very one-sided legal situation currently. I think it's very important that we increase the sort of legal defence and the backing for those decision makers who are trying to do the right thing to avoid Australia being sued for another $300 billion, for example. And indeed, maybe balance out the scales about who can take decision makers to court. And indeed, this is no denying, would actually help those who'd like to bring cases to challenge the opening of new fossil fuels. But I think that it's really a very minor legal tool in comparison to what the big corporations have at hand.
So there's quite a few groups that have spoken to give evidence to the hearing this morning. We have been able to see the Youth Climate Coalition and aligned groups present their views, and they were extremely compelling. We've also been able to hear Director of ICEDS, Professor Mark Howden, speaking on behalf of his submission to ATSI, talking about the social cost of carbon and also the underpinning rationale for why we need this bill.
What the evidence is in the science shows is that accumulations of greenhouse gases are already significantly increasing risks to physical health and mental health for young people across the globe, and that's unevenly spread. So some places are affected more than others, and some groups are affected more than others. So those people who are already suffering from poverty and gender issues or other stresses in their lives tend to be more impacted than others. What we can see from the science is our current trajectories of greenhouse gas emissions, which are being pushed up by those sorts of large projects that you refer to, are going to increase temperatures across the globe. They are going to increase extreme events, and those are going to impact on young people as they grow up. And there's increasing evidence of both the physical and mental impacts, both acute and chronic mental health impacts on young people from climate changes, as well as on issues such as domestic violence, which is linked to temperature, and we've seen recent studies which show those linkages. Mm-hmm. So if we were looking to argue from a point of equity and justice for those people who currently have a voice in the political system, the voters, as well as those people who don't have a voice in the political system, which is the young people, we would actually be incorporating their views. The science is unequivocal, and the IPCC in its last assessment report said that the human influence on global warming is unequivocal. There is no uncertainty associated with that. We can't explain the warming we've observed without including the human influence on greenhouse gas emissions and other factors such as land clearing. So in that sense, the science is very robust. We can also see analyses which look at things like the social cost of carbon. So that's the accumulated costs and benefits, so the net costs and benefits of emitting a tonne of carbon. And the US EPA just recently redid their assessments for the purposes of inclusion in the US system, the government system over there. And they're, it varies depending on discount rates and timing, but roughly speaking, $300 a tonne of for a tonne of carbon dioxide emitted. There's been recent studies which, whilst they have a wide range, the median number for that was $417 a tonne, so I think $600 Australian for each tonne of carbon. And that's because the benefits from emitting that tonne of carbon are grossly outweighed by the costs, and those costs include things like impacts on young people.
So just to clarify on that, you're saying that they're saying that the cost of emitting a tonne of carbon is in the range of $300 to $400
a tonne. That's right. Yeah. And so the way those analyses look at is that they look at a global scale, because every tonne of carbon eventually gets spread around the globe, so you have to look at it from a global scale. You add up all of the positives that might occur, warmer conditions, which increase length of growing season, say, in Scandinavia, against the negatives, such as increased health burden on people in the equatorial regions. Mm-hmm. And you do that over a period of time, and then you add up all of those numbers and you come up with a net cost. And the fact that it is so grossly negative, in the sense that there's a cost of carbon, tells you something about how our approaches are asymmetrical in terms of considering immediate benefit from emitting carbon versus the long-term cost.
Join me now as we listen to Patricia Carvelas on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's Radio National Breakfast program, talk with Chris Bowen.
The development of renewable energy across Southeast Asia isn't just crucial to reduce carbon emissions, it's also going to be big business. But concerns around transparency and sovereign risk have dampened private sector enthusiasm. Enter Australia, which yesterday announced a $2 billion finance facility to help fund green energy and infrastructure investment in Southeast Asia. Chris Bowen is the Minister for Climate Change and Energy and our guest. Minister, welcome.
Good to be back with you, PK. Good morning.
There's $2 billion on offer here. Can you provide us some examples of the sorts of projects this fund will finance?
Oh, well, there will be a plethora of projects that will be looking at the financing ability made available yesterday by the Prime Minister. I mean, this is about economic development in our region and the first, second, third and fourth orders of business for that economic development are green energy. And when I'm talking to my ministerial counterparts, whether it be in Indonesia or Singapore or Malaysia, or indeed the private sector, or indeed, you know, international bodies like the International Energy Agency, it's very clear that Asia's, Southeast Asia's in particular, energy needs are going to skyrocket over the coming decade as part of economic growth, and making sure that growth is fueled by renewable energy is a challenge for the region, and we can help. And there are economic opportunities for our country and opportunities of massive cooperation. So this is a big step forward. It was one of the key recommendations of Nicholas Moore's report to the government last year about deepening economic engagement with Southeast Asia. And as Nicholas said, this is the main game for economic development in our region.
Okay, so what will the return on investment be for Australian taxpayers?
Well, of course, there'll be every applicant will be assessed against the return. This is a very standard measure of government support. Governments of all persuasions have deployed vehicles like this over the years for various reasons. None of them have, you know, developed into a problem for taxpayers. They have delivered a return for taxpayers. But the standard sort of assessments about bond rates and plus returns will be given to every single applicant, and there'll be a rigorous process on each approach. But we'll be working closely with governments in the region to ensure not only value for the Australian taxpayer, but real value add for the economic and renewable energy transformation in our region.
Many of the Southeast Asian countries this fund seeks to assist have authoritarian governments and problems with corruption. What rules will be in place to protect and ensure the money is well spent?
Well, we have strict, in all our existing interactions with Southeast Asia, PK, Australian laws and guidelines are very strict about our interactions with the private sector in Southeast Asia, and those same rules will apply.
I want to move on to another topic, another thing you've been working on, and that's the fuel efficiency standards you're planning to introduce. Can you tell us exactly what this policy will do to the car market?
Well, what it'll do is give Australians better choice. Now, we are, with Russia, the only major economy without these standards. They've existed in the United States since the mid-1970s, for example. And as anybody who's been to America or watched American TV shows knows, they have a wide range of choice of large cars. But what your listeners might not realise, PK, is that cars in the United States, for example, are 20% more fuel efficient than Australian cars. Despite the size of their fleet, they are 20% more efficient than our cars. That is because we do not have vehicle efficiency standards. We are really a very large outlier. As I said, only Australia and Russia, so Europe, China, Japan, United States, Canada, New Zealand, Saudi Arabia, India, have all had these standards in place for several years. And as a result, surprise, surprise, car manufacturers send more efficient cars to those countries which require it as a matter of law. So Australians have been missing out on choice. And it's about EVs. Yes, there's a much broader range of choice of EVs in other countries than Australia. But it's not just about EVs. There are existing models of petrol and diesel cars for which there are more efficient models available overseas. Now, this is about choice for Australians. It's a way overdue reform. It's been talked about in Australia for 20 years.
I understand
years
all that,
more.
But there are questions about its implementation, which I think are reasonable. You haven't released any modelling on what car brands and what car models will be most impacted. When will you release the modelling?
We've released 80 pages of analysis, PK.
But you haven't released the modelling. Why not?
Because there's confidential, there's commercial and confidence matters contained in some of the documents we
but
have.
Won't but won't it settle some of these questions? Because well, PK, there are lots of questions.
PK, I invite you, if you haven't, to read the 80 pages of analysis that Catherine King and I released a month ago, which is very substantial, which is also in keeping with the approach that Paul Fletcher took when he, to his credit, was trying this reform. He tried this in 2015, 16 and 17. When he was a transport minister, he made all the points that we are making. He released analysis, not modelling, as did Josh Frydenberg, who was partnering with him on this. It showed, their analysis showed no increase in Australian car prices. Our analysis shows no increase in Australian car prices. There has been no increase in Australian car prices, in car prices in any country where this has been introduced over the last 50 years or so. What the opposition and some others want us to believe is that Australia would be the exception. Now, Australians deserve these better choices. It is way overdue for Australia, and that's why this government, in a careful, deliberate way, we've consulted very widely, and a consultation and a preferred model closed on Monday. We have taken a very considered approach, but it is a reform way overdue the interests of Australian motorists.
You're currently consulting on it, right? The industry says the current model that you prefer is unworkable. Are you prepared to look at a scheme which is implemented over a longer period of time?
Well, let me make a couple of points, PK. With respect, you just made a sweeping statement about industry. That is not actually correct. If you look at Hyundai, Volkswagen, BMW, Kia, Volvo, they've all supported the model we've put out very strongly. Strong statements of support from those manufacturers. People like the NRMA, Australia's Peak Motoring Group, have supported our model. Choice, the Australia's Peak Consumer Group, have called for standards like this. Now, there are some other companies who say, look, this is going to be, there are other companies, you know, that have said they would prefer a lighter model. I think inadvertently, PK, I think inadvertently, that argument is actually making the case for reform. That argument is pointing out that actually they are sending Australia cars that are not as efficient as the cars they are sending elsewhere. And they have a lot of catching up to do, and they are asking for longer to catch up.
Oh, there's no doubt that we've been getting the less efficient cars. I don't think anyone's contesting that. It's about the price ramifications. So there are obviously other options you could look at. Would you look at a longer implementation timeframe?
Well, as you said, PK, we have put this out in a very considered and deliberative fashion. We had several consultation papers last year, which there were hundreds and hundreds of submissions. Catherine King, the Transport Minister, and I worked carefully through those. We then put out a preferred model. There were three models we put out. We put out a preferred government model. Consultation on that closed on Monday. You don't put out consultation without reading the submissions, considering the points made. Where people have made good points in good faith and where they've made sensible suggestions, of course.
And what do you consider so far? Just want to get a sense of the direction you're going in, given some of the criticisms. What are some of the sensible ideas? Because they've suggested there are other ways to help consumers, super credits, cash incentives. Are they sorts of things that you are willing to consider?
Well, we have incentives in Australia already. Our electric vehicle tax cut, for example, is by some analysis the second most generous tax concession on a permanent basis in the world for taking up EVs. So let's not have the argument put that there are no incentives in Australia for more efficient vehicles today. I'm not going to preempt the submissions we've received or the work that Catherine and I will do, but Catherine and I have taken a very consultative approach. We'll continue to do so, but nobody should doubt our commitment and our determination to ensure better choices for Australians. And finally, taking this reform, PK, from the too hard basket, where it's been for years, and putting it on the to-do list. Australian motorists deserve nothing less, and we intend to do that.
And so the implementation is meant to be at the beginning of next year. Are you considering a later start date?
No, we want to be getting on with this, PK, because this is coming about 20 years too late.
It certainly is the case that we are in the category with Russia. There's no dispute about that. But obviously, when you've got some car companies, and I take your point, it is not universal, but some who are saying that they're going to jack up prices, that's an issue, isn't it? Because people will hear that message and they'll be worried.
Well, I understand there's a scare campaign underway. I mean, we're used to that. This is, you know, this is 2019, this will end the weekend stuff from the opposition.
Isn't the problem, though, that it may work if it's coming from the companies saying we're going to increase our prices if this goes forward?
Well, again, PK, it hasn't increased prices anywhere in the world. What some people are asking us to believe is that Australia would be the only country where it would increase the price of any particular model. That is not what our analysis shows. It's not what the previous government analysis showed. Paul Fletcher was very clear about that in his public statement. He made the point, you know, that cars and utes in the United States, after the introduction of efficiency standards, I'll quote him for you, PK. This is Paul Fletcher, member of the opposition, who said, so when fuel efficiency standards were introduced in the US, the most popular models before introduction stayed the most popular models after introduction. There wasn't a material change in price. And we don't expect there would be a material price change in price here. Mm. That was the Liberal Party, just a couple, not ancient history, not 15 years ago, just a couple of years ago. The only thing that's changed is that they're now in opposition and they opposed not only our policies, the policies they were advocating.
They do have a different policy, and now some of the car companies too, as I say, and as you pointed out, accurate. It's not all, but Toyota's saying that the standards will mean people will hold on to their older and dirtier vehicles for longer. Does that concern you?
I understand that not every car company welcomes new and better regulation. But we would expect all car companies to act in good faith, put in their submissions by all means, and we will consider them. We will consider sensible suggestions which keep the government's policy intention of better choice, cheaper to run cars, lower emissions, cars that are healthier. You know, there are big health impacts for Australians of having cars that are more efficient. On our roads, there'll be very strong and positive impacts on respiratory health. We will deliver this reform again. We had two consultation papers last year. We put out a preferred model. It's the way Catherine and I do business. We consult and we listen, but nobody should doubt our determination to act in the national interest, not in the interest of any particular car company.
Yeah, I understand that you think that this is the right thing to do, and we are the last cab off the rank. I mean, really, at least in the...
It's not generally a company that we seek to keep in policy terms, good governance terms.
I'm just trying to work out what the consultation entails, how prepared you are to listen to some of these critiques in your final model.
As I've said, you know, we don't do consultation to not read the submissions. We do consultation to read the submissions. Where somebody has made a good faith suggestion, which is in keeping with our intent to give Australians better choice and better cars, of course we'll consider it.
And would a longer implementation, is that within the spirit of the intent?
Well, as I said, this is a reform which should have been delivered to the Australian people at least 5 years ago when the previous government tried it. I mean, John Howard actually took this policy to the 2001 election and then failed to implement it. What we're not interested in is delay for delay's sake. There's no point saying, PK, let me just be very frank, there's no point people saying we support a vehicle efficiency standard as long as it doesn't work. I mean, that is effectively what you could argue for by saying, sure, a vehicle efficiency standard is fine as long as it doesn't change our behaviour or make us bring more efficient cars to Australia. That's not an argument we're interested in. If there are sensible suggestions in keeping with the approach we've taken so far, of course we'll consider them. But we will be delivering better choices, cheaper to run cars, lower emissions cars for Australians, which previous governments should have done years ago.
Thank you for joining us this morning.
Always a pleasure, PK. Good on you.
That's the Climate Change and Energy Minister, Chris Bowen.
Join me now as we listen to a 3AW radio talkback host, Tom Elliott, talk with a Extinction Rebellion protester who was on the Westgate Bridge on Tuesday just past.
Good morning, Tom. I just want to correct the record. Traffic is not at a standstill. We've left two lanes open, so traffic can move. It has been slowed down substantially, though, on Wilson Street.
All right, what are you protesting against?
We are calling on the Albanese government and the ASEAN leaders who are in the country at the moment to acknowledge the scientific reality and to formally declare a climate and ecological emergency. We've reached the end game. We're in the era of global boiling now, and on our current trajectory, the world's leading climate scientists tell us we're heading for a hell on Earth and the collapse of human civilization, and we won't stand idly by and let that happen.
You really think we're headed towards the collapse of human civilization?
That's what people like Will Steffen have said. Will Steffen is one of the most esteemed climate scientists in the world, and he said on the current trajectory, we're heading for the collapse of human civilization.
Right.
We won't be able to grow food on a mass scale, Tom. And if you think people lost their mind over toilet paper in the supermarket, what do you think they're going to do when they can't feed their family?
Well, they'll be very angry. There's no doubt about that. Now, there's 9 leaders from different Asian countries like Thailand and Indonesia and Laos and Vietnam here in Australia. Do you think they're listening to you?
Well, we're hoping they do. We can't guarantee that, obviously, but this is one way that we can get a platform and to get our message out there and hope that the message gets through. First and foremost, we're calling on the Albanese government to acknowledge the scientific reality, but we're also calling on the ASEAN leaders because that middle latitude around the Earth, where most of Asia is, that will be the hardest hit by a warming planet. They'll be the first to have mass crop failure.
Then there'll be mass
migration, Tom, and we know how well that turns out.
Do you think the average person in Asia who's just struggling to get enough to eat, do you think this is a message that they'll want to hear? Will they be receptive to it?
I think a lot of people are very receptive to wanting to put food on the table for their family. And I think when people join the dots and understand that in a warming planet, they're not going to be able to grow food on a mass scale and do that anymore, I think they will. This is why we're calling on governments to tell the truth. Because if government gets up there and tells the truth about the situation and where we're headed, people will respond.
Do you think blocking traffic and, you know, making people's trip to work that much harder and longer, like you are doing this morning, do you think that will convert people to your cause?
Well, obviously it's going to upset some people. I understand that. If I was in the traffic, I'd be upset too. And we genuinely wish it didn't have to come to this. But I don't think anyone who accepts the science on climate, any rational person who accepts that science, is going to say, I don't accept the science anymore because Extinction Rebellion blocked the traffic. That's just not going to happen.
Well, but no, but I mean, but you need to convert people. I mean, that's the whole point of this. I'm just saying, by stopping people getting to work or slowing people down, do you think that will convert them to your point of view?
I think people, if they honestly process where the science is at and they look at what the governments of the world are failing to do, sooner or later they're going to realise that the political class is not going to save us unless we put the appropriate amount of pressure on them. And the best way to do that, history has told us, is through mass non-violent civil resistance. That's why we're trying to build a mass movement. That's why we'll be on the streets from March 13th to the 16th, and we're calling on people to join us, and you can find all the details on our social media and ozrebellion.earth.
Okay, so just on that, so March 13 to 16, so just over a week away, what are you going to do? You're going to shut down the CBD or what?
We're going to engage in non-violent civil resistance. So, yes, there'll be more disruption. We did it in December, and it'll be pretty much a rinse and repeat of what we did in December. There'll be a massive slow march on the Saturday. People can join, very entry-level stuff, but there'll be a mass arrest at the end of that where people will sit on the road and refuse to move. And there'll be other actions during the week, more targeted, and also some slow marches in the city.
Hey, you might be on the wrong road. We've just had an off-air tip-off that, in fact, the ASEAN dignitaries are coming in on the Tullamarine Freeway, not the West Gate, so your protest might be in the wrong spot.
Well, we picked this spot because we knew it would get the media attention it deserves.
Right.
We weren't actually targeting the ASEAN leaders in that sense, but we picked this spot because we knew the media couldn't ignore it.
All right, well, thank you, Brad. Brad Homewood there, Extinction Rebellion protester. Well, you can't doubt his passion, but I could say this without shadow of a doubt. He will not be winning any, if any, converts to his school of thought by blocking people getting to work.
Let's move now to a story from the New York Times. It has the headline, "Weirdly warm winter has climate fingerprints all over it," study says. The story begins. Winter was weirdly warm for half the world's population, driven in many places by the burning of fossil fuels, according to an analysis of temperature data from hundreds of locations worldwide. That aligns with the findings published late Wednesday by the European Union's climate monitoring organisation, Copernicus. The world as a whole experienced the hottest February on record, making it the ninth consecutive month of record temperatures. Even more startling, global ocean temperatures in February were at an all-time high for any time of year, according to Copernicus. Taken together, the two sets of figures offer a portrait of an unequivocal warming world that, combined with a natural El Niño weather pattern this year, has made winter unrecognizable in some places. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. I really appreciate you joining me. Now, please don't forget to check out the show notes because my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis. I can't comment on them all, but I'll put as many as I possibly can in the show notes. So go there, check them out and read them and make some decisions about how you will respond to the climate crisis. Also, it would be great if you were to share this with your friends, put it on your networks, let people know what's happening with the climate crisis. Also, I'd love to hear from you, and you can contact me at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. So, until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet, it's fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.